This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello out there, and welcome to the Men's Hour, brought to you by Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. We're going to bring you some stories from a couple of different magazines today. We're going to start off with a short story about Clint Eastwood. Definitely one of the man's mans out there, right? He's still going strong at the age of, I don't know, is he 99 maybe? Anyway, this is a story called The Truth About Clint Eastwood. The legendary actor and director is a complex man whose life is filled with enormous contradictions. On the set of 2024's Juror No. 2, the film's star, Nicholas Hoult, asked his director, Clint Eastwood, to explain Clint's own approach to acting. He said, "And it's an emotional and instinctive art form," the British actor recalls. "So don't think too much, just do." It's advice the legend is also lived by. In the 70 years since Clint, 95, he's not 99, he's 95, spoke his first words on film playing a lab assistant in Revenge of the Creature, he's become one of America's most prolific, although sometimes underappreciated, actors and directors. Yet despite so many decades in the spotlight, the guiding principles of this deeply private man have never been easy to pin down. "Every time I got a little closer to some aspect of his films or his life, I'd be surprised," Sean Levy, author of the new book, Clint, The Man in the Movies, tells Closer. "I think the contradictions of Clint continue to fascinate. Born in San Francisco, where many of his films were based, Clint grew up in an upwardly mobile family that moved often during his childhood. He was a tall, quiet, kind of dreamy boy who was always a new kid and always getting picked on," Levy says. "That experience helped inform the stoic, self-reliant characters like the Man with No Name of the Sergio Leone Westerns Clint would become famous for. They're men who show up in a place and alter the social fabric that already exists," Levy explains. "I think that's how he sees himself." Left and right. Clint has never been afraid to challenge his fans' and critics' perceptions of him. "Culturally, our image of him keeps shifting," Levy says. "In the 1960s, he was almost a counterculture figure," he notes. "Then Dirty Harry was sort of a right-wing figure. Clint also played goofball roles, such as the truck driver whose best friend was a chimpanzee in Every Which Way But Loose and the subsequent sequels. I think there's a lot of Clint in Gran Torino, where he's a miserable old loner, but when he sees injustice being done, he has to stand up." The social issues Clint's chosen to champion in public have been diverse and often disparate. "He ran for mayor of Carmel-by-the-Sea, California, on a platform that seems liberal," Levy notes. "He's a land conservator, but he supported Republican presidential candidates. He has owned a handgun for personal protection, but he's not a gun nut and he's not a hunter. He loves animals." Strong women have always appealed to Clint, both in his films and in his personal life. The Los Angeles Times in the 1980s called him a feminist filmmaker, says Levy, pointing out that many fiery actresses he's directed, including Hilary Swank, who won an Oscar under Clint's guidance for 2004's Million Dollar Baby. "I think he has a certain admiration for women who can hold their own," Levy says. "For a white man born in 1930, that's a pretty open-minded perspective." The women Clint's loved most in his personal life have been formidable, too. "It wouldn't have been easy to be a woman in his life," Levy notes of the star, who's been twice married and had at least three long-term love relationships. These were women with backbone. They weren't girly girl or trophy partners. However, when it comes to love, Clint has struggled with long-term monogamy. "I think he believes in love," says Levy. "His feelings are true, but they have boundaries and time limits on them." Family man. Clint and the mothers of his eight children all deserve credit for creating a warm, close, blended family, despite divorces and acrimonious splits. Although the actor brought his kids to film sets, he's largely tried to keep them out of the spotlight. "It wasn't anything like a Hollywood upbringing," Allison Eastwood tells Closer. "I have a deep love and respect for animals, nature, and wildlife from growing up in Monterey County, California, and also from my parents just being very kind, loving people. The whole family gathers annually for Thanksgiving and for big events like last year's wedding of Clint's youngest child, Morgan. Clint walked her down the aisle at 93, says Levy. They truly are a family. Clint Eastwood's 93 and he has a kid who's just now getting married. The actor who lost Christina Sandura, his partner for over a decade, to a heart attack last year, devotes a lot of time to his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. but his film directing days are not necessarily over. He's really been ill, but he takes care of himself, Levy says of the star, who used wellness practices like twice daily transcendental meditation since the 1970s. There's talk of him looking at new scripts. If his health is up for it, I can see him doing it. If there's anybody who can pull it off, Clint's the guy. Here's some pictures that you can't see, obviously, but he was married to his first wife, Maggie Johnson, from 1953 to 1984. So she was with him the longest. And there's a picture of Clint and his children and his ex-wife, Maggie, posed together at the premiere of his film, The Mule, in 2018. So he still seems like he's a pretty good family guy. I'm sure he has lots of grandkids and maybe great-grandkids by now. But anybody who can still be friends with his ex-wife's okay in my book. If you want to learn more, look up the book, Clint, The Man and the Movies, written by Sean Levy, L-E-V-Y. That's Clint, The Man and the Movies. And I'll tell you what, my wife loves Clint Eastwood. She was a huge Dirty Harry fan, which is a little scary sometimes. But I'm gonna give her that book because I think she'd love to read it. I hope you would too. Now here are some stories from Game and Fish magazine for the Midwest, September of 2005. There's one on fishing. Bass fishing, to be specific, which is a big deal here in Missouri, as you all know. Celestial concerns. How seriously should anglers consider the influence of the sun and moon on bass feeding and behavior? If you're an experienced angler, I bet you've looked at the lunar, moon, and solar sun and moon tables in magazines or newspapers or online and wondered what value do they have? Do they really work? Can they teach us anything about fish and game behavior? It's likely you've had a conversation about these tables with a fishing friend that went something like this. You, do you pay attention to those peak times tables? Fishing buddy, not really. For me, the best time to fish is whenever I can. I can't pick and choose when I go. I'm too busy for that. Of course, that's flawed thinking. It's precisely the anglers who can't go fishing at the drop of a hat who should do all they can to make sure they're on the water when the odds are in their favor. Leave it to fishing guides and tournament anglers to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fishing conditions. They truly have to fish when clients or tournament organizations demand they be out there. The rest of us are usually lucky enough to do a little picking and choosing about our fishing time. But even guides and tournament anglers have much to gain by studying the impact of the sun and the moon, assuming the tables and charts are worth the paper or pixels used to publish them. A little history. Lunar or solunar tables are not new, and predicting the path of the sun and the moon is almost as old as mankind. Astronomers and early man have long associated moon phases with things like the tides and animal activity. However, it wasn't until the 1930s that outdoorsman, naturalist, and writer John Alden Knight started to connect solar and lunar phases to fish behavior. He initially referred to it as his inland tides theory in 1935, but since tides are caused by the sun and the moon, he decided to combine the words solar and lunar and call it his solunar theory. In a nutshell, Knight's solunar theory is based on the idea that fish, actually all wildlife, are more active during certain positions of the sun and moon relative to that fish's position on the earth. The sale of his solunar tables saw Knight and his family through the Great Depression and beyond. And those same tables, or those created and marketed by later rivals, have led many anglers and hunters to greater success outdoors. After Knight's death, an outdoorsman named Dan Barnett began publishing Dan Barnett's Fishing and Hunting Times, again predicting peak fish and wildlife activity. He highlighted solar events and his tables were popular, but lacked precision. The basics. Knight identified certain key periods that occurred in each 24-hour cycle. He called them major and minor periods. The major periods were when the moon was directly overhead or underfoot. Minor periods occurred when the moon was rising or setting. The strongest period of each moon were the full and new moons. This is simple, and you might not need a sophisticated table for that. You could look up the lunar cycle and get a pretty good estimate of when those things are going to occur in your part of the planet, but it would be very general. Adding the sun's influence on fish to these early tables was essential. After all, the sun is the engine that drives all life on Earth. If you were to say that bass tend to feed when the sun A, rises, and B, sets, and C, in the middle of the day, especially in the winter, and D, the middle of the night, especially in summer, well, you'd be onto something. Doug Hannon's Moon Times is another popular and highly regarded resource for leveraging the natural influences of Earth and Moon. The late bass professor was focused on trophy bass and believed strongly that the full and new moons were the most impactful periods. Like nights, Hannon's system narrows key feeding windows into major, moon overhead and underfoot, and minor, moonrise and sunset windows that typically last 1 to 2 hours. More is more. In 1986, fishing writer Rick Taylor came out with his Prime Times, certainly the most sophisticated and precise solunar predictions available to date. Taylor maintains that not all full moons, new moons, sunrises, sunsets, noons, and midnights are equal. He factors in the diurnal certainties of the sun and the Earth's 24-hour spin with the daily variances of the moon to bring greater sophistication and precision to his work. After all, the moon passes over our heads 45 to 60 minutes later each day. That's a variance that the most basic tables do not consider. Rather than adopt the inaccurate doggerel that has hindered or obscured much of the useful solunar work over the past century, Taylor identified 7 periods that influence bass each day. There's a lot of them, so I guess that covers a lot of the day, but here they are. These include dawn, noon, heat of day, dusk, midnight, moon overhead, and moon underfoot. His recommendations and predictions are more practical than they are celestial, offering real-world value rather than crystal ball hype. Dawn and dusk are powerful drivers for foraging, especially if the bass has a visual advantage over its prey. Noon can spark a plankton bloom, triggering feeding activity all over a body of water. Heat of day is when the sun has maximized its daily impact and is a positive in cool or cold weather, but generally a negative in summer. Midnight can be a primary driver of nocturnal feeders or of all fish in hot weather. He maintains that moon overhead and moon underfoot are typically most productive during stable weather. Those are solid words to fish by, even if you're not interested in looking at a chart. However, what a quality solunar table does is calculate and calibrate all those factors so then you can home in on exact times to be on the water. Taylor also gives each day a score of 0 to 100 so you can tell immediately what potentially it might have, solunarly speaking, of course. But it's the hour-by-hour or minute-by-minute calculations that are most valuable. Can you imagine that? We all have favorite spots to fish, that point where we hooked our personal best, or the creek where we won the club championship. Who doesn't want to be there when the bass wake up and start eating? Consider other factors. Does slavish adherence to even the best of the solunar tables guarantee more and bigger bass? Of course not. On any given day, the patterns of the sun and moon are just a few of the factors that affect our fishing. Weather patterns, water clarity, water temperature, current, and a whole slew of other things can be far more influential at times. It's also true that a bass is a living, breathing creature with a brain all its own, even if that brain is the size of a pea. Just because conditions are right, it doesn't mean that particular bass is hungry or feeling well or willing to chase after your offering. All the solunar tables can do is predict when the sun and moon are best aligned to influence behavior such as feeding. The rest is up to us, as I hope it always will be. Pick your moment. Ultimately, the solunar theory is a lot more useful than most anglers realize. It's not just for those lucky enough to pick their fishing days and times. It's for anyone who wants to make the most of their fishing opportunities. It's even for guides and tournament anglers who don't get to pick the days and times they fish. They should use the solunar tables to put themselves in the best spots at the best time available to them. If they truly believe one area has the greatest potential for numbers of bass or large fish, doesn't it make sense to be there when it has the greatest potential to produce? That's where the solunar tables can help even those anglers who must fish on certain days and at certain times. Now let's go back to the dialogue that started this article, but reconstruct the conversation with what we've learned. Fishing buddy, should I be paying attention to those solunar tables? You, absolutely. Fishing buddy, when? You. Whenever you go fishing. So that's just a little bit of tips for those bass fishermen out there. Might be helpful. And the last guy they talked about was Doug Hannon's Moon Times, which is the more recent version of what was developed decades ago and looks like it's one of the best resources for solunar timing. There's actually a page here that I can't read to you, but it's a calendar, August, September, October, that shows every day what the best times are for fishing bass. And it's color-coded to tell you which ones are the best days, which ones are the good days, which ones are the fair days, and then when the full moon is and the new moon and all that kind of stuff. So it usually looks like there's like a two-hour window in the early morning hours, like in some cases it's 12:30 a.m. to 2:30 a.m. And then the mid-afternoon hours, 2 hours in the mid-afternoon, there's a set of times each day. And again, it gives you the dates, it kind of highlights in which ones are the best days to go. And you can use those to help figure out when and where you should be fishing. If you want to own your own 2025 Doug Hannon Moon Clock, go to moontimes.com. Again, that's moontimes.com for a 2025 Doug Hannon Moon Clock. And you can get some science to tell you when is the best time to fish. Now here's a short article. Around the Midwest, it's a sampling of the region's best hunting and fishing opportunities this season. And it shows like there's six different places and six different things that you can hunt for or fish for, depending on across the Midwest states. Dust off your blaze orange. Fall is here, almost. Doesn't feel like it right now, but it will be soon. Camping becomes more tolerable this month, fishing picks up, and many hunting seasons open once again. With so much going on in September, your dance card is sure to be full most days. Waterfowl hunters can enjoy early seasons across the region, like Illinois' September Canada Goose opportunity. Doves open on the first of the month in most states, and Indiana offers public dove fields at various fish and wildlife areas. The youth deer season is a big deal in Kansas this month, too. And if you wish to cool off, consider wading an Ozark stream for feisty smallies. Spend your time wisely, and you can experience some of the best fishing and hunting of the year right now. Now, here we go, 1 through 6, and the first one's right here in Missouri. And we were just talking about bass, weren't we? Show me smallmouth. Missouri has incredible smallmouth bass fishing in its southern rivers and streams. To celebrate the best bronzeback waters, the Missouri Department of Conservation, MDC, created the Missouri Smallmouth Slam, which recognizes anglers who've caught a smallmouth in at least 6 of 12 streams: Big Piney River, Big River, 11 Point, Elk, Gasconade, Jack's Fork, James River, Joachim Creek, Merrimack, Mineral Fork, Osage Fork of the Gasconade River, and 10 Mile Creek. Each has a specific area that qualifies for the slam, which can be found at mdc.mo.gov. Successful anglers can have their name listed on this site. So a lot of smallmouth bass in our southern rivers and streams, and a lot of these rivers and streams are, you know, within a couple hours drive or less from St. Louis. So if you like to fish and you want to maybe be listed in the state's website for winning the Missouri Smallmouth Slam, check it out at mdc.mo.gov. Next up, we've got Michigan. Michigan fall turkeys. The Great Lakes State's fall turkey season opens in mid-September and is an underutilized way for hunters to collect their Thanksgiving bird. Busting up a flock of turkeys may not sound sensible when trying to call one in, but it works quite well in the fall. Finding birds is the main struggle in fall turkey hunting. If you find them bunched up, run right at them so they panic and scatter in multiple directions, then sit down and call them back together. You should find good flocks in the Huron-Manistee National Forests. And here's something from our neighbor to the east, Illinois. Illinois geese. There are more than 6 million Canada geese on the planet. Many say that's too many, especially in areas like lakeside parks, subdivisions, and golf courses. Yeah, where we live in Florida, we've got a lake right by our house, and the geese are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. Additional Canada geese seasons have opened in many states, including Illinois, where the early goose season runs from September 1st to the 15th. The season is open statewide, and you can take 5 Canada geese daily. Possession limit is 15. Wren Lake, which is a few hours east of St. Louis, and Marshall State Fish and Wildlife Area, which provides access along the Illinois River, are 2 top public hunting spots for geese. Demand for goose hunting spots isn't super high, though, so you can often obtain permission on private land. Number four, this is from Indiana. Hoosier doves. A high-quality dove sheet's fast action is the perfect way to kick off hunting season, and Indiana offers plenty of good opportunities. A couple of top public fish and wildlife areas with managed dove fields are Atterbury and Goose Pond. Doves will roost overnight and head to water early. Set up between a wood line where they're roosting and the nearest water source, and solid shooting should follow. Bring lots of shells, as even crack shots miss a lot. I mean, doves are not that big. Hunting along fence rows next to grain fields is ideal. Doves are great table fare. Wrap the breasts in a piece of bacon, soak in a little Worcestershire, salt and pepper to taste, and grill to medium rare over charcoal. I would not have thought there'd be enough meat on a dove to make it even worth your while, but I guess it is. Number five, this one's from Minnesota. Trout Run Creek Trout. Some consider Trout Run Creek near St. Charles to be Minnesota's premier trout fishing destination. It's located in western Winona County and flows into the middle branch of the Whitewater River. With easy access, Trout Run sees a lot of anglers, but it still produces outstanding angling days. The Minnesota DNR reports that brown trout abundance is high, with estimates of around 100 brown trout greater than 12 inches per mile. Per mile! 100 brown trout greater than a foot long, which are keepers, per mile. Anglers can access Trout Run Creek within the boundaries of Whitewater State Park. And our last one is our neighbor to the west, Kansas youth deer. Deer hunting is a big deal in Kansas, and the only thing more exciting than tagging a big sunflower state buck is watching a kid do so. The youth season runs from September 6th to 14th. Youth hunters under 17 must obviously be under the immediate supervision of an adult 18 or older, and all participants in the hunt must be wearing blaze orange. Many landowners will open the gate to a youth hunter, so try seeking permission on private land. Those sticking to public ground should hit southeast Kansas, which has many public properties. This includes 13,000 acres of quality deer habitat at Mined Land Wildlife Area, which also offers great fishing and camping opportunities. So those are six different hunting and fishing tips for the Midwest. Again, we've got smallmouth bass in Missouri. We have geese in Illinois. We have turkeys in Michigan. We have doves in Indiana, trout in Minnesota. And finally, we have deer season for kids 6 to 14. Deer's youth season runs September 6th to the 14th for kids under 17. So there's six things to put on your plate as something to do this year if you are a hunter or a fisherman. Now here's a story for the hunters out there. This one's titled, this is all also from Game and Fish from September. Rainforest monarchs. Native to the Pacific Northwest, jungle-dwelling Roosevelt elk are very different from their Rocky Mountain cousins. These guys are huge, with huge, huge racks here. All right, so let's see what this has to say. The morning air was calm when my buddy Jody Smith let out a gentle cow call. Fresh elk sign surrounded us on the warm September morning. Swiftly, a bugle came firing back through the coniferous forest. Moving to the side of the trail before we could get set up, another bull bugled, then a third. We were surrounded by bulls, all within 50 yards of us. They were unusually vocal for Roosevelt elk. No words were exchanged. They weren't necessary. Smith and I have spent countless hours together in the elk woods over the last 25 years. We've both figured it'd be a done deal in a matter of seconds. For nearly 10 minutes, the bulls bugled back and forth. We called sparingly, figuring the bulls would surely move toward one another on their own, and we were in the middle of it. Knowing we were in a perfect position, we waited. Then one bull frantically started gathering cows on the uphill side of us. It sounded like a bulldozer plowing through the thick foliage of the coast range. Tree limbs snapped, rocks tumbled, and vines were shredded. Cow and calf chatter escalated, and the woods erupted with bugling bulls. Two bulls moved closer to us, one from below, the other from the side. In less than a minute, the woods fell dead silent. Had you not been there to witness what we'd heard, you'd have thought there wasn't an elk within miles of where we stood. In all the commotion, we never saw a single elk. We could smell them. We could feel the hard ground trembling as they ran, but we couldn't see them in the thick brush. That's Roosevelt Elk Hunting. Continuing education. I've learned a lot since my first Roosevelt elk hunt in the early 1980s in my home state of Oregon, but I'll be the first to admit I still have a lot to learn. I rank killing a mature Roosevelt bull to be the second hardest big game hunt in North America, preceded only by Columbia black-tailed deer. And yes, I've hunted coos deer, moose, sheep, and brown bear, the jungle-like habitat Roosevelt elk thrive in, and their ability to negotiate some of the most rugged terrain in the country makes them a worthy adversary. Roosevelt elk thrive in the Coast Range and on the western slopes of the Cascade Mountains in the Pacific Northwest, from Northern California all the way to British Columbia. Public land hunting opportunities abound in Oregon and Washington, as do over-the-counter tags even for non-residents. Serious Roosevelt elk hunters are largely a secretive bunch. They're hardworking, they scout all summer, and they dedicate most of their free time to learning all they can about these reclusive animals. They share little information. You won't find them flaunting their finds on social media. One winter, I was delivering a seminar on Roosevelt elk hunting at a big sports show in Portland, Oregon. Afterward, a man approached me and thanked me for the insightful information. We shook hands and parted ways. He attended my seminar the following year and the one after that, and each time he commended me on the thoroughness of my seminar and how he was always left having learned something. That's when I asked the man if he'd filled his Roosie tag that season. "Yep, I sure did. Thanks for asking," he said. We talked. The man was quiet and humble, a true gentleman. As it turns out, that most recent bull was his 26th straight Roosevelt elk he killed with a bow. He showed me pictures of some absolute monarchs he'd taken, all on public land in the Coast Range, all by himself. He's the one who should have been delivering the seminars, not me. I enjoy bull hunting Roosevelt elk for the simple reason of being able to listen to these giants when their testosterone levels run high. If nothing else, the sound confirms you're hunting in the right spot. But these bulls are not always vocal. In fact, of all the Roosie bulls I've called in over the years, more than half have come in silent. Early one September, it was dry and hot, and the woods were noisy. Smith and I were hunting public land on the Coast Range. Using intense cow calls, what was known as a hyper-hot cow call back then, I got two bulls bugling on the ridge above us, but they wouldn't budge. Just when we were getting ready to move on them, Smith caught movement below us on the steep ridge we were sitting on. I called again, and a Roosie bull materialized and closed within 15 yards. I put an arrow through it, then called aggressively as the bull trotted off. It stopped, turned, looked at us, then came trotting right back in. It collapsed two paces from where it had been hit. A year later, Smith and I hunted the same ridge. We called for more than an hour without hearing or seeing an elk, then continued down the ridge, calling at two more sets. We didn't hear a bull, so we turned to hike back out. When we neared the first calling site, two big bulls stood right where we'd been. They busted us. Had we been patient and stayed put, we might have killed one of those bulls, possibly both. In the thick of it. In addition to being one of my favorite people to hunt and spend time with, Smith is also a full-time guide. It's jodysmithguideservice.com, and Jody's spelled J-O-D-Y, so jodysmithguideservice.com. His family came to Elkton, the tiny town Smith still calls home, in 1846. Nestled into the eastern slopes of Oregon's Coast Range, the town is aptly named, and Smith's family has been hunting Roosevelt elk since the season first opened for them. Smith guides a number of Roosevelt elk hunts every year, as he has for nearly 40 years. With Roosevelt elk, you have archery season, which takes place during the rut. Then there's the general rifle season, Smith says. Almost all the archery hunts take place in the timber or very near cover. But with rifle hunts, there are two choices. Dive in and hunt the dense timber, or focus on open meadows and log units where longer range shots can occur. Today, I think there are fewer Roosevelt elk hunters heading into the brush than when I was younger. That's a shame, as that's where most of the big bulls are. One day in the mid-1980s, Smith headed into the timber above his boyhood home in search of Roosevelt elk. It was raining, blowing and cold, perfect elk hunting conditions, he recalls. At first, I grabbed Dad's 270, but as soon as I stepped outside and saw how hard it was pouring, I figured that a scoped rifle wasn't a good choice. So I took my Remington Model 8 chambered in 300 Savage with a peep sight. "If you find one, just keep shooting," Dad told me as I headed out. Soon, Smith was in the timber. I got up there before daylight and it was almost pitch dark in the forest, Smith recalls. I had to sit and wait a long time for enough light so I could even see an elk. About 10 a.m., I finally spotted a bull and it was big. It was walking parallel to an old, overgrown logging road I was on. It was raining and blowing so hard the bull had no idea I was there. Just inside 50 yards, I hit it behind the shoulder. As the bull ran off, I could hear Dad's voice in my head, "Just keep shooting." So I did. I hit it two more times. The big 6x6 went down the steep ridge and I found it piled up against a big fir tree. To this day, it's the biggest bull I've ever shot. Smith went back home and got his dad to help handle the beast. The first thing Dad did was build a fire, take out part of a backstrap, and cook it, Smith recalls. That was Dad's ritual with every bull we killed, no matter how hard it was raining or how much work we had ahead of us. I miss those times. Hiding in plain sight. Back in my days as a host of an outdoors television show, a number of industry friends wanted to hunt Roosevelt elk. Not until they set foot in the dense rainforest of the Coast Range did they realize what they were up against. Very few of them even saw elk, let alone shot one, despite being in elk every day of the hunt. That's Roosevelt elk hunting. If you want to hunt these bulls in the timber, you have to realize that a 50-yard shot is long, even with a rifle, says Smith. I've helped him open a lot of trails and shooting lanes over the years for his bow hunters. Many shots come at 12 to 15 yards. Under 30 yards is an average bow shot for us, but a lot of times it's half that distance, Smith says. Remember, those bulls are giants, way bigger than a Rocky Mountain elk. So when hunters see a big bull come in so close in thick cover, it catches them by surprise. For bow hunters who struggle to walk the needed miles every day in steep terrain, Smith has turned to ground blinds. Scouting to find where bulls are coming out of the timber to graze in small meadows, then setting up ground blinds has been a game changer for a number of archery hunters. It's something not a lot of Roosevelt hunters do, but it's sure been working good, he says. While Roosevelt elk densities are highest in the Coast Range, they're also thriving on some valley floors between the Coast Range and the Cascades. In recent years, some giant bulls have been taken by archery hunters up and down the Interstate 5 corridor. One bull that scored close to 380 inches, what is that? That can't be right. 300, I wonder how, when would they measure? Was shot within sight of one of my favorite duck hunting spots, smack on the valley floor and within sight of the freeway, for God's sakes. He shot at this huge elk right by the freeway. As with all elk, Roosevelts aren't opposed to finding an easy way to survive. If they can feed on private lands year-round, they'll do it. One thing that never ceases to amaze me about Roosevelt elk is their ability to expand their range and adapt to new habitats. It even appears that more bulls are growing bigger in conjunction with their expansion due to their ability to avoid hunters and predators. Where I grew up in the western foothills of Oregon's Cascades Range, Columbia blacktails were king. There were never any elk. Then in the late 1980s, they started trickling in. The hunting for these elk peaked in the 1990s and the early 2000s. Today, many herds have moved even farther to the west, and they're hard to come by in locations where they were plentiful 20 to 30 years ago. The elk made their way down into river drainages meandering through Oregon's Willamette Valley and spread across rolling hills studded in oak trees. They now thrive in agricultural fields fringed in cover on both sides of I-5. Crossing a major freeway is nothing to them. Would be to me if I ran into one, right? Roosevelts are strong, can overcome obstacles, and with little effort, cover many miles. But there are limits. 5 years ago, much of the Roosevelt elk's range in the Cascades and Coast Range of Northern California, Oregon, and Washington was devastated by massive wildfires. Multiple herds were reportedly engulfed in flames in the big Holiday Farm fire near my home that scorched more than 170,000 acres. That's sad. Many herds fled and haven't returned to the areas that burned extra hot. I doubt they ever will, not in my lifetime anyway. But the elk on the fringes of many burned areas are coming back. During the last two falls, I observed multiple elk herds returning to areas where the burns were less severe. Here, food is flourishing and cover, though sparse in areas, is just enough to hide even these big creatures. Having spent most of my life in Roosevelt elk country, the frequency with which big bulls are being taken by archery and rifle hunters continues to increase. 4 seasons ago, not far from my home, an archer arrowed a 391 6/8-inch bull, Oregon's second biggest Roosevelt on record. With every passing season, I hear of and see more and more giant bulls being taken. Again, many of these successful hunters fly under the radar with good reason. All-consuming passion. Just like the black-tailed deer that thrive in this brushy habitat of the Pacific Northwest, Roosevelt elk move like ghosts through the forest. Watch a herd of 50 animals pass within 30 yards without making a sound, and you'll be dumbfounded. Set eyes on just one monster bull, and you'll instantly understand their allure. Most who spend a lifetime chasing these elk fall short of ever laying eyes on a truly colossal bull, but all it takes is one encounter, one instance of being in the right place at the right time, and your perspective changes. Nearly 20 years ago, one of my hunting buddies, the late Russ Matthews, shot a big bull on the western slopes of the Cascade Range not far from our homes. As was the norm, Russ had headed into the timber alone. He preferred hunting thick, wooded draws with water in the bottom. Back then, the general rifle season was in October. On dry days, water was hard to come by, but Russ would find drainages with water flowing in them, hunt them all the way to the bottom, then hike back up to his truck. Some drainages were so big and rugged, hunting just one of them was a daylight to dark endeavor. He'd put a pack on his back and take off, often not coming out of the woods until well after sundown. One night, I got a call from Russ. He'd finally found the big bull he'd been chasing all season. He first laid eyes on the bull when scouting in the summer. His description of the velvet-colored antlers made them seem larger than life. Russ had killed a lot of bulls, but this one had him especially excited. With his 416 in hand, Russ headed into the brushy creek bottom, covered in towering Douglas fir trees and heavy brush. Where the conifers met thick stands of blackberries and deciduous trees, Russ found the bull. It was alone, as is often the case with big post-rut roosies. As the bull grazed through a patch of sparse willows and cottonwoods, Russ took aim. One shot was all it took to anchor the big bull. Russ had the bull mounted. It hung in his tiny house. To sit on Russ's couch, he had to duck under the nose of the big bull. It took up nearly one quarter of the living room. Russ didn't care. He'd killed some big bulls and bucks over the years and was a renowned trapper in the valley, but this was the only mount he had. Shortly after that, Russ passed away. That big bull was one of his most prized possessions. Roosevelt elk do that to a hunter, even the most seasoned of us. Now here's a side article about what kind of guns you want to use to hunt Roosevelt elk. Roosevelt elk firepower. Guns, loads, and optics considerations for big roosies. When it comes to choosing a rifle for hunting a Roosevelt elk, there's a decision to make. If hunting in the timber, count on visibility being limited. Many big bulls are killed every year by hunters using iron sights, though some will use fixed 4X scopes, others 1-4X. If opting to hunt with a scope in the brush, remember that the chance of heavy rain is high. I'm talking upwards of 2 to 3 inches a day, not just a shower here and there. I mean, we're talking Oregon, where it probably rains more than just about any place on earth. A .45-70 lever gun shoots slow, but the big bullets are hard to beat for the largest bodied elk in North America. The old standby .375 is also great for close range shots. Any 30 caliber rifle can do the job with good shot placement, but shots are usually taken in rugged land where anchoring a bull is a priority in order to save hours of tracking and packing. Therefore, the bigger the boar, the better. Roosevelts can absorb bullets like no other ungulate. For hunters focusing on burns, log units, and open habitat, shots can be long. A 300 Winchester Magnum is hard to beat. I'm a big fan of the 28 Nosler for these and all elk. In recent years, I've seen a number of Roosevelt bulls taken with Browning's 6.8 Western. Shooting Browning's 175 grain long range Pro Sierra tipped Game King bullets, the 6.8 setup has more energy at 500 yards and beyond than most factory loads in a 300 Win Mag. A scope with an illuminated reticle offers a big advantage, as shots are often taken in heavy shadows amid dark timber in the early morning and late evening hours when daylight is scarce. The illuminated reticle leaves no guesswork as to where the crosshair is, something that's not always straightforward with thin black crosshairs. I've been impressed with Leopold's VX6HD3 18x44 scope with their fire dot duplex. The battery-operated reticle is clear and precise, and the custom dial system adds speed and accuracy to this setup that is completely fog and waterproof. So those are some tips on what to bring with you when you go into the woods to get a Roosevelt elk. More firepower is better, definitely. Here's our last story for this week, again from Game and Fish Midwest. This one's about deer hunting. Overlooked edge plays. Many whitetail hunters focus hard on hunting fields. However, looking beyond traditional agricultural borders, one can find all sorts of edges that deer often travel. Interesting. Versions of the idiom, "you can't see the forest for the trees," date back to the 16th century, but it essentially describes someone so bogged down with details that they can't see the entirety of a situation clearly. This, of course, can apply to many things. For whitetail hunters, being too rigid and caught up in traditional details can cause us to miss an opportunity we might otherwise notice. One mindset that many deer hunters all too easily lock into is a singular focus on hard edges of habitat. With this tunnel vision, they can often overlook the subtle edges pressured deer, particularly mature bucks, may follow. Find one of these hidden borders and you might be on track to waylay a buck before it ever reaches a time-honored edge during shooting light. Look past the usual agricultural perimeters and you could discover a hidden world of whitetail edge activity waiting for you. Riparian ribbons. Under the radar, whitetail edges may be difficult to discern unless you have whitetail DNA, so let's start easy. Search for any riparian ribbons on a property. Riparian means of, on, or relating to the banks of a natural course of water. The course of water could be flowing year-round, or it could be seasonal, or merely the remnant of a long-ago river, creek, or stream. A stream coursing through open country is immediately apparent when scouting, standing out like a streaker on a televised soccer game. That's funny. The overlooked riparian edges disappear in stands of timber. When you combine terrain variations, the possible lure of water and the lushness of vegetation near riparian zones, they become very attractive edges for deer, places worth uncovering. Makes sense. Go where there's water and where there's food, right? Your job is to not only discover a riparian ribbon underneath an existing canopy, but to also find the edge most alluring to whitetails. First, investigate the steepness of the banks. Deer will follow a bank until they find a path of minimal resistance before crossing. Steepness can also force deer into a pinch point, such as along an adjoining steep hill. If water is flowing, deep water can also hinder deer travel and influence their edge pathway, including crossing points. Sandbars, beaver dams, and rocky riffles all provide easier routes to cross water. Livestock find these channels and carve out even deeper trails along edges leading to crossings. Follow the hoof prints, big or small. Oxbows are a final geographical element to locate. A hunting app like HuntStand provides a satellite view to help see terrain, topographical, and vegetation changes, all indicating big bends in winding riparian zones. Focus on the backside of an oxbow or its deepest bend. Whitetails seek out these recesses as secure bedding cover in thick pockets of alders, willows, and other brushy cover, like invasive Russian olive trees. My favorite tactic is to walk along dry river or creek banks to circle downwind. Once behind the oxbow, I climb the bank and hang a tree stand smack in the depths of the oxbow cover. It's a great all-day sit as deers will move about with confidence in these areas, off and on all day. Vegetation avenues. Walk through your favorite park or take a hike along a popular hiking trail. As you get in your steps, survey the surroundings and observe how different topography aids in supporting a variety of habitats. Those habitats ultimately include different species of vegetation. Some transitions between dominant vegetation types have subtle edges, while others feature a hard edge. Take notice because whitetails do and oftentimes base their travel on the vegetative edges transitioning into a world already choked with flora. For example, a vegetation edge where a cluster of choke cherry bushes ends and a hardwood forest begins, while not clearly visible from satellite imagery, can ultimately be an edge that influences whitetail travel. As you begin scouting for these subtle nuances of vegetation, consider existing elements such as wetlands, lowlands, and uplands. All vary in their soil makeup, and that basic element often influences the type of foliage found in an area. When the terrain changes dramatically, expect equally striking changes in the associated plant life. Those are your edges to analyze. For any number of reasons, woodlots and timber stands often include openings. You can spot these with the help of your hunting app. But sometimes a canopy of leaves can obstruct that view. If you stumble across these small openings, their ridges could be as productive as the rim of a turnip food plot. The browse species along the edge and interior have power to lure whitetails into an edge pattern. Whenever I'm unsure whether a subtle edge sees activity, I look for visual cues. Rubs and scrapes indicate use of subtle edges. Early in the season, scrapes may just begin to appear, but during September, rubs, both from stripping velvet and the start of seasonal aggression, appear along all edges. Since testosterone-fueled anxiety is just kicking in, search for old rubs as much as new ones. New rubs, often freshly tanned in appearance, offer evidence of current activity, while older rubs, those losing that tan color or turning gray, reveal a history of buck activity from past seasons. Both types of rubs together suggest an edge that bucks prefer and see lots of activity and travel, and a spot deserving further scrutiny for a potential ambush. Man-made means. The highways, railways, and cement paths humans have built over decades create a plethora of travel routes for the upright. However, these human intrusions into areas inhabited by whitetails also create edges that deer travel, often in unlikely places. Sure, the seasonal addition of agricultural fields and their subsequent harvest produce edges, but think past those conventional conduits. More intensive study is needed to discover the diverse array of man-made travel routes. The millions of miles of fence strung across the country represent one such overlooked edge. Although deer can easily jump most fences, they do become lackadaisical in some environments and instead follow a fence to get from point A to point B. Tight fences, tall fences, and fences along geographical barriers, cliffs, and waterways prompt deer to follow the wire. The utility lines and pipelines you rely on for running water, electricity, and gas are other examples. These utility corridors are found throughout the country, and companies usually maintain open spaces around them to facilitate quick repairs if required. Find one of these utility passages on a hunting property, and you have yet another possible overlooked whitetail edge. Beyond edge routes, these spaces also double as browsing areas. Scout the routes for a win. Finally, be aware of any past changes to the landscape on a hunting property. Ask the current deed holder if they know of old clearings, overgrown farm trails, homestead foundations, and windbreaks of yesteryear. All can potentially provide a hidden edge or trail that deer could funnel along during daily travels. Although thick vegetation may hide an old road to a dilapidated farmstead on first glance, deer may still use it to visit old orchards or even bed in the shadow of tumbled buildings, offering weather protection. One fall, while bow hunting in Kansas, a farm manager showed me the location of the original homestead, now overgrown deep at the bottom of a coulee. A barely discernible road led to the pioneer shambles and then out to fields beyond. Also visible along the ancient road were hoof prints and fresh rubs every few hundred feet. Knowing that a soybean field lay on the opposite side of the coulee and that deer likely used the thick cover surrounding the forgotten farm for refuge, I quickly set a tree stand in a downwind location. 3 sits later, a trio of bucks sauntered down the trail returning from the soybean field. A dose of dominant buck lure on a wick paused the biggest one long enough for me to deliver a fatal blow. So those are some really good tricks of the trade when looking for where deer may be. Never thought about any of that. And our next story or two are going to come from, believe it or not, People Magazine, August 18, 2025 edition. I don't know about you, but one of my favorite shows when I was growing up was WKRP in Cincinnati. And it wasn't just because of Lonnie Anderson. Now, she was a big factor in liking that show, but I thought it was funny and edgy and just hilarious and just love it. Just love that show. And we lost Lonnie Anderson this last week. And here's an obituary for her. And this belongs in the men's section because she was one of the most beautiful women from when I was growing up. And I'm sure that was that way for you too. Lonnie Anderson, 1945 to 2025. Farewell to a TV goddess. Sharply funny as an anything but dumb blonde on WKRP in Cincinnati, she survived a brutal breakup with Burt Reynolds and lived to remember the good times. With her solid platinum hair and curved physique, Lonnie Anderson didn't object to being considered a sex object. "I embrace it," she said in 2021, "but playing dumb blondes, that she could do without." Auditioning for the sitcom role of WKRP in Cincinnati's Jennifer Marlowe, a receptionist at a mismanaged radio station, she made it clear that she thought the character was vacuous. As she recalled in a 2020 interview, "I went in and sat on my little soapbox and said, I don't want to play this part because she's just here to deliver messages and is window dressing." Creator Hugh Wilson had an idea. "Let's make her look like Lana Turner and be the smartest person in the room." She wisely accepted and stayed sensitive to blonde jokes. WKRP, which aired on CBS from 1978 to 1982, made Anderson a star, earning her two Emmy nominations and establishing her as a savvy TV goddess, a kind of forerunner to Christina Hendricks' Joan on Mad Men. The show also gave her the clout to be paired with superstar Burt Reynolds, first in the 1983 movie Stoker Ace, and then in real life. He swept her into a storybook romance and then dragged her through one of Hollywood's most memorable, vicious breakups, what the Los Angeles Times called the ugly divorce that just wouldn't end. Anderson died in Los Angeles of an undisclosed illness on August 3rd, 2 days shy of her 80th birthday. She's survived by her fourth husband, Bob Flick, a musician, as well as his daughter Deidre, 60, from her first marriage, and son Quentin, 36, from her marriage to third husband, Reynolds. "She has a real talent with a glowing sense of humor," wrote her friend, I Dream of Jeannie star Barbara Eden. One in a trillion. She's one of those sitcom stars from the 70s and 80s that is still alive. Barbara Eden is, and beautiful as ever. In addition to a buzzy role as Jane Mansfield in a 1980 TV movie that co-starred Arnold Schwarzenegger, of all people, Anderson's WKRP years were probably the high point of her career. She would end up spending decades dealing with the fallout of her toxic relationship with Reynolds, who died in 2018. They began dating in 1982, and 5 years after filming Stoker Ace, married at his ranch in Jupiter, Florida, where guests included Anne Margaret, Jim Nabors, he sang Love Is Here to Stay, ironic, right? And Robbie Benson, who said the newlyweds looked like the perfect couple, the kind you see on top of a wedding cake, only bigger. That same year, they adopted an infant son, Quentin, but at some point, the honeymoon faded and died. Reynolds, who blindsided Anderson with divorce papers in 1993, accused her of being a shopaholic. She bought everything in triplicate, from everyday dresses to jewelry to china and linens, and of forcing him to go almost 3 years without love in the biblical sense. But Anderson responded in 1995 with a best-selling memoir, My Life in High Heels. "I waited until I was no longer angry, bitter, hurt, or anguished," she told People. She'd kept plenty of ammo in reserve, though. Reynolds, she claimed, had been physically abusive, addicted to painkillers, and reluctant to fork over child support. Reynolds didn't pay off the divorce settlement until 2015, just 3 years before he died. The St. Paul native, who married fourth husband Flick in 2008, once said she didn't regret her sometimes turbulent romantic history. "My husbands have all brought lovely things to my life." In 2021, accompanied by Quentin, she even unveiled a memorial bust of Reynolds at his grave, saying, "I just want to remember the good times." That's a great way of looking at things. And the great, beautiful, talented, smart Lonnie Anderson passed away last week at the age of 80. And here's one more story from People magazine of August 2025 about Machine Gun Kelly, of all things. MGK, rock star survivor. The musician, formerly known as Machine Gun Kelly, gets candid about fatherhood, facing haters, and showing his sensitive side. MGK, the artist born Colson Baker and formerly known as Machine Gun Kelly, is discussing his new album when a couple from his hometown approach him in the lobby of his New York City hotel. "Dude, Cleveland is like Fight Club. There's an if you know, you know aspect to it," the Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter, 35, says as the pair walk away. "It's like a major respect thing that we all have for each other." Since launching his music career nearly 20 years ago, MGK has gone from hometown hero to one of rap and rock's most electrifying acts, amassing a passionate fandom and more than 9 million Instagram followers. There are detractors, too, criticizing his vulnerable lyrics and genre melding, but MGK has learned to shrug them off. "I became so hated for what has become apparent to me, no reason. just because I artistically express myself through fashion, music, whatever, because I choose to not stay contained into a societal box. MGK unleashes that spirit on Lost Americana, his seventh and most ambitious LP. On the nostalgia-tinged album, Out Now, he blends pop, punk, and hip-hop while trying to make sense of love and loss and fame. His tabloid-fueling on-and-off romance with actress Megan Fox, 39, with whom he welcomed a daughter in March, may or may not be an inspiration. Maybe this time, he says of his haters, they'll get to know the man-slash-broken boy behind the moniker, MGK. He also has a daughter who's... his daughter Cassie looks like she's about 16, so he must have had a daughter through another woman before Megan Fox. Growing up, MGK was bullied and had a difficult relationship with his strict dad, who struggled with his mental health and kicked MGK out of the house after high school. As a teen, he learned to cope with music. I guess I don't really know what else to do with all those pieces, says MGK, who hustled for years before breaking out with his debut in 2012. And becoming a dad to daughter Casey, 16, from a past relationship, and her daughter Saga with Fox, redefine what family means to him. It recharges your will to live battery and recertifies your you have a purpose here sticker. MGK has also found purpose in songwriting. Vulnerability is how I was able to hold on to the fan base I've had for so many years, he says. The human behind the music has to show the human side. He does just that on Lost Americana. One standout track, Treading Water, appears to reference a tumultuous time with Fox. Neither has spoken about the current status of their relationship, and MGK declined to comment. I'm a Rolling Stone, man. You're bound to continue hitting rocks and obstacles. It's just the path I chose, I guess, MGK says of navigating difficult times. He's long been open about dealing with anxiety and depression and managing his mental health today means that I have to live in a place of positive affirmations right now, he says. So speaking into existence what I would like, I'm so effing happy, tattoo that on my tongue. These days, MGK finds happiness in the little things, like Jim Carrey movies. He recently rewatched Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, and quality time with his family. He spent his last day off chatting with his grandpa about what to carve out of a tree trunk in his backyard. Yes, the rapper turned punk rocker is a woodworker. I'm working on a set of spoons and forks, he says. If that's not Lost Americana, then what is? So that's more information than I knew about what the guy formerly known as Machine Gun Kelly, now MGK, and estranged from the great Megan Fox, and a father of two. Well, that's all the time we have, folks. Hope you enjoyed it. I try to bring you new stuff every week, different things, so hopefully you're liking that. Tune in again next week and listen to all the great programming available to you at Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Take care, everybody, and stay cool.